Good morning, dear listeners. You are listening to Radio 3CR on 855 AM in Palestine, remembered with Nasser Mashni, Robert Martin, and Yusuf Ahmed Rimawi. Of course, I'd like to say hello to our guest in the studio this morning, Khaled Mashni. Good morning, Nasser and Robert.
Good morning, Yusuf.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Palestine Remembered is Australia's only radio program that is totally dedicated to the Palestinian cause in English. And we'd like to welcome our listeners who are listening to us now live on the
855.
Yes, sometimes you go, what? 855 AM. And those who will join us later on the podcast page, 3cr.org.au/podcasts.
Now, today is International Day of People with Disability, and so our listeners have an opportunity 12 years later to finally hear about Yusuf Rimawi and his life and his journey to Australia, but also particularly, for those that don't know, his life with his disability.
Yeah, so I think the International Day of Solidarity with People with Disability is an occasion where maybe people who don't get to see what it actually means for a person to live a life of some form of difficulty or disability. In fact, Nasser, you know, on my way here, I remembered a proverb in Arabic that I will try to translate. It says, "الصحة تاج على رؤوس الأصحاء لا يراه إلا المرضى." Good health is a crown on the heads of healthy people that only unwell people can see.
Yeah.
Which means,
wow. Yeah, wow.
I don't know if this makes sense in the translation.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's beautiful.
So, yeah, we're just before we start, perhaps I'll just the working definition of disability in Australia is any condition that restricts a person's mental, sensory, or mobility functions. It may be caused by accident, trauma, genetics, or disease. A disability may be temporary or permanent, total or partial, lifelong or acquired, visible or invisible. Now, Yusuf, yours is actually visible. Those that have met you can know that you walk with a limp and a crutch. Can you tell us about your condition?
I was born in 1974, and my early childhood was in Saudi Arabia. When I was 10 months old, I contracted the polio virus, and that was through an error, a medical error, because in the 70s, the syringes were not disposable, so which means that you need to reuse the syringe or the needle. You just need to make sure that it's sterilized, and you need to boil it so that you could use it again, unlike these days where you just use it for one time and you throw it away. So the error was that the doctor didn't do the sterilization. And that's why when I was injected with something to bring my temperature down, it also contained the virus for polio. And so I was 10 months old. I don't remember, of course, life before polio. And in fact, it could take several forms based on the nature of the virus and how it lives in your body and what procedures you take to overcome it. So in my case, it affected my muscles, the left leg muscles predominantly, and part of the right leg. And what that means is the muscles are weaker, and you cannot stand on your I can't stand on my leg. That's why I need a brace and a walking crutch to get by.
Mm-hmm. And how common was polio, you know, in Saudi Arabia in the early 70s there?
I guess in comparison to Australia and the Western world, it's very common, because I don't have figures, but I know that polio was eradicated from the Western world and Australia in late 50s maybe, and that's why it's unlikely to see people in their 40s or younger in Australia with this syndrome. Whereas in the Middle East, that's not the case. And I'm an example. And here we're talking about a rich Middle Eastern country, Saudi Arabia, let alone being in one of the poor ones. So I guess how common it would be doubles the figure.
So if you could take us back, Yusuf, to Saudi Arabia and, you know, your life between Saudi and Jordan, your experiences as a child amongst your family, how did your family make you feel? Mm. I mean,
I have to say that there is a cultural element involved here, and that could be, you know, both when I say culture, it also includes religion, because Muslims believe, according to their articles of faith, there are 6 articles of faith, and number 5 is al-Iman bil-Qada wal-Qadr, and you have to believe in fate and destiny. And when something like this happens, it's a test of your faith and belief in Allah, and therefore your reaction shouldn't be to challenge or to feel why me, or to feel victimized by this. And you just say all praises be to Allah and move on. However, the some people could go far and even not question why the medical error happened, and not even apply for compensation if they are entitled to, and because they might view it as
questioning
Allah's decision.
God's will, yeah.
And that's not what my father did anyway, but I'm here trying to include also other aspects or cultural aspects and disability that might not be here in Australia. Excuse me.
What were the support services like? I mean, I know we're in Australia, and you know, whether it be a handicap sticker or you know, wheelchair access, doorways and ramps to government buildings, the reality is Australia is perhaps a
progressive,
very progressive, but altruistically, you know, espouses a very inclusive, non-discriminatory policy.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
That's not the case in most of the Middle Eastern countries, Arab countries, at least the ones that I have been to. That would be Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and a couple of other Gulf countries, with exception to Emirates. But we'll come to that.
I think we should also note that you know, in Palestine, 1999, Yasser Arafat legislated the most progressive legislation bill on disability compared with anywhere in the Arab world, and that, you know, it's a real model of a disability legislation model, you know, very Western, non-discriminatory, etc. And, you know, government services must be allowed to cater for and include. Nobody can be discriminated against for a job, etc., based on a disability, visual or otherwise. So
that's my other Palestinians who live in Palestine tell me, in comparison to Jordan, for example. So I've heard about this from people who live in Palestine and also travel to Jordan. So in do you want to say something?
I just wanted to ask what you've done since, like, school, because I know you and I have spoken and you've got some pretty heavy credentials. So the disability hasn't really held you back at all, and I think that's a marvellous thing. If people don't see you, they wouldn't have a clue. Can you just tell us a little bit about what you've done since that? Because I know that you have, as I said, some pretty heavy credentials.
Thank you. I think this could be attributed to my father's and my mother's attitude towards my attitude to disability. And that brings us to how you deal with limited resources. And I remember in the when I was 5, I didn't know that I have a disability, because I was just a happy child. I was embraced by everyone, my other friends, my relatives, and all. My dictionary, my discourse in disability was that my leg hurts. Although it didn't hurt, it just, this is how I used to refer to it. The first time I realized that I'm different is when I was about to go to school, and that was when I was 5, and I needed to get a leg brace. And there was a medical procedure that was a prerequisite for leg brace. And when I was admitted to that operation or surgery, I thought that by the completion of of that, I will be able to just jump and run and like Firas, my younger brother, or every other friend. But when that operation ended and that didn't happen, that was a little bit of disappointment. I remember that, okay, when can I now start running? So I guess I also want to refer to the to being non-Saudi in Saudi Arabia and access to medical facilities. And I don't want to say that they discriminate against Palestinians. It's simple there. It's black and white Saudis, non-Saudis. Now, access to leg brace or to just be diagnosed and to get the fittings was not allowed for, let's say, Palestinians or non-Saudis living in Saudi Arabia in 1980. And what that means is that we had to apply for special consideration and we have to get the signatures of somebody. It's just like more bureaucratic procedures. And you have to travel to 450 kilometers away city. And then you get the, of course, in the old days, they used to do it by pen. They take the measurements of the leg by pen. And then they make the first brace and then you come back to... So it's a very lengthy and very... so lengthy, so complicated that even a 5 or 6 year old boy recognized the difficulty, to the extent that when we went back to my first fitting, it was terrible. It was painful, and when they asked me how do you feel, Yusuf, I said, "Oh, it's okay." I didn't want to say it's painful, because I didn't want my father to go through more of this
bureaucratic
nightmare. And by the time we went back, it was bleeding. Yeah. And so my father said, "Should have said something."
Should have said something. Now, you know, in a loving home and a supported home, even though we're diaspora Palestinians, you know, and you're a refugee, yeah, in Saudi Arabia, as welcoming as they thought they were.
Mm.
Talk to us about, like, did you feel that you missed out on things?
I have to say that I was one of the lucky childs with disability, because I had a younger brother who accompanied me in every step, especially to school. You don't get this luxury. I mean, a brother going to school because you can't carry your bags. He was actually 4.5 years when I was 6. And the decision, okay, off you go for us. You're going to school because Yusuf is now going to school.
That's
you have
amazing.
To carry. You have to carry two bags. You have to worry about the bodyguarding activities, and you have to get him food in the break lunch, and poor thing for us was like, okay, I'll do it.
He grew up quickly.
He grew up, and you know, and we traveled all the way up. It was a journey of 11 years. Going to school each and every day together and sitting next to each other. And it was like a bit of a teamwork where I do the homework, he would do
his physical labor,
everything else.
That's a perfect day.
And in fact, it took me till I was 17 to know the boundaries of my disability the first day of me going to school without Firas.
Okay.
And I didn't know that you have to develop some techniques and skills to adapt with your disability. But I was totally dependent on Firas, especially with access to school, when you have stairs, when you have like a slope or something. Now I have to worry about this alone. And back to your question, Nasser. Maybe because I had this luxury, I have my younger brother who had to worry about every activity that I had to do. Maybe I didn't feel that I was disadvantaged. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a hypothetical question. What would have happened or how
without
Firas? I think it would have been pretty much like an impossible mission. Because I remember our class was on the third floor in the first 4 years. And I remember that we had to walk back home. And I remember things that I, simply by carrying my own bag, as simple as that.
I've known you for more than 10 years now, Yusuf. And I know how fiercely independent and strong-willed and determined you are. There is no way that it would have been impossible. You would have overcome whatever obstacle has stood in your way. So,
thank you.
Let's not. Can you tell us? And Yusuf had dinner with us on Monday night. We're talking about when you went off to PLO camp.
Yes.
Tell us about the first day and your mum's reaction.
Of course, we were talking about the Palestinians in diaspora in the late 70s and early 80s. They had a national project and they believed into that project, and they felt obligated to send their own children to youth camps and to teach them the life of, let's say, I don't want to say the militant life, because it was not militant. It was just discipline and to attend, let's say, awareness classes.
Yeah, nationalistic and revolutionary.
Nationalistic revolutionary type of.
Yeah.
I have three brothers and one sister, and my mom was okay with her two kids going. That would be Iyas, the older, and Firas, the younger. But she struggled to accept, why would Yusuf, who had just made his very first steps a few months ago, because I just had my leg brace, would have to go to one of these camps and would have to spend 45 days in another country doing military activities that would be working, you know, marching and things like
that.
How
old were you?
I was 6 years old. My first youth camp, and I remember a bit of argument between mom and dad, that not Yusuf, maybe when he grows up a little bit, but my father had a plan B that he didn't tell her about. He said he will be looked after. He actually had spoken to people in the camp, and he made sure that I will be okay.
But this is a testament to the nature of the Palestinian. You know, the loss of the land has created a determination. Determination not to allow adversity to overcome us.
Yeah, it wasn't.
And so your father was not going to forgive your disability and say that Yusuf wouldn't be like his brothers,
no.
Wouldn't be like every other Palestinian's done to attend
something. You know, and the first day, my father took me to a place, and there was a blind boy. Mm-hmm. And then I felt, oh, well, then I can't complain.
You felt sorry for him.
I felt that I'm luckier. He went to the camp with zero vision, and he felt that he needed to be there. His parents also, he was as young as myself, and that's why it wasn't an option where you just say, okay, you just send kids.
Well, you know we've talked about your disability and the tragedy of a non-sterile needle getting given to you with a fever. The reality of Palestinians under occupation, whether they're in Gaza, in East Jerusalem, or on the West Bank, they're dealing with the Israeli army occupation force and the military industry that practices on Palestinians and uses that practiced and work technology to sell
and
as a marketing.
On purpose.
On purpose, of course. So we've got a situation where, you know, people have the tragic situation. You've got a mistake, let's call it. We've got people born like that, the six-year-old boy with blindness. But in Gaza, in East Jerusalem and West Bank, we've got Palestinians that become disabled because an Israeli sniper shoots a boy with a rubber bullet, you know, a steel-coated bullet with a millimeter of rubber, and they call that a rubber bullet.
Like it shatters bones, it shatters muscle.
Like as if it's supposed to bounce off a child. Or dime ammunition, you know, the dense, inert metal explosive. It's got tungsten, a known carcinogen that they dropped in Gaza that was severing limbs in the past couple of Gaza invasions. Can you talk to us about your experience with respect to those kids? And we're talking, you know, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands since 48, 67 that have, in some cases, and I know, Shimon Peres, they laud him as some sort of peacemaker, but we remember, you know, the Intifada of breaking the bones when he gave instruction to the army to break the bones. And there's some footage on YouTube, and our listeners can download that stuff, where soldiers are bending kids' arms backwards against their elbows and snapping the arms just to teach them not to throw a rock, to resist military occupation.
There's also the post-traumatic stress syndrome as well that a lot of people don't talk about, that it's forced upon them. And, you know, they see their parents being abused, shot. They're taken out of their homes at 3 a.m. in the morning. They're handcuffed. They're taken to Jerusalem where their parents aren't allowed to come and see them. They're taken to Jerusalem so there's no legal representations. They've got the, when they lock them up for no reason as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Robert. And here it brings me to the main difference between people who become disabled because of an injury, and in this case, because of an Israeli intervention, and myself, because I grew up into it. I didn't know what it actually means to jump or walk or run So there was less emotional burden and pressure on me. I had accepted my disability. I didn't even realize that it existed before 6 years old. I didn't know the boundaries before 17, the real boundaries, of course. I knew some boundaries. But in the case when you are, let's say, in your 20s or you are a teenager and you are an active in sport or something like that, and then the next day you can't get up, or you can't walk, or you can't.
Well, I mean, we could talk about the Gazan soccer players. You remember when they were trying to attend the Asia Cup and the Israelis shot them in the foot?
Exactly. He was four times. Very active people, not let alone normal people. Mm-hmm. Here, there is huge emotional burden and also mental burden that people who are born with disability do not have. So we have to acknowledge the difference and the contrast here, because I have seen people we met in Algeria. There was a conference about detainees or prisoners in Palestine, and some of them became disabled in their imprisonment in Israel. And some of and on purpose, they were injected periodically with injections that they didn't know what it was, and later on it created some forms of disability in the joints, in the bones. And I have seen people who in their 30s who can't walk because of that, and they actually think that I'm lucky. Because at least, you know, I didn't lose anything when they had something
to lose.
So I think it's systematic in Israel. I don't think it's a weapon they use against us. They do it with political immunity. They are held not responsible, or they're not held responsible for that by any international UN body. And I think the time has come for the world to recognize that Israel gets away with a lot of inhumane and immoral systematic policies, and that's only one of them. I also have read reports about when they shoot to scatter, let's say, a demonstration or a gathering, they deliberately target knees, and they deliberately won't these people not to be able to walk again, because if you shoot the knee, then that's it, you have lost.
I met one of the young kids that got shot in the leg, and it went up his sciatic nerve. He'll never walk again. And it was the bullet came in from the back, and one of his closest friends died because he got shot in the head, and that was only a few years ago. He had Benatsky. So it's obviously something that they do and they get away with, because there was no charges ever laid. The problem with poor Iyad's child is that he got harassed after the fact, because he was shot, and they wanted to keep harassing him so he wouldn't say anything. And the thing that makes me so sad is that we can sit in here and we get all emotional about what we've seen and we know. Outside these walls, no one is doing anything.
No. You know, even I even feel more angry and more sad when I see that some of the IDF soldiers come to Australia for holiday. And probably a few weeks before they are here, they were shooting somebody, they were killing a child, or they were making a Palestinian permanently disabled. And in the forms that you have to apply to come to Australia, I've seen so many of these forms because of my work with Aspire and refugees. And I don't think they have answered the questions correctly. Or they had answered the questions truthfully, but the Australians give them special consideration, because there was a question about have you been involved in any military activity or something like in armed or
armed conflict,
armed conflict, and you are involved in any form of combat, military combat. Now, if you take yes, and then nevertheless you come to Australia, what does that tell you about our system?
Separate laws.
Yeah.
Special consideration.
It has to be.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, unless they take them into a room for 28 hours and question them as to why
happens.
They're there.
I don't think that
happens. It only happens to us.
No. And then send them back.
You have to have brown skin to get sent back, I think.
I also, I think we are heading towards the end of the program. If you allow me, Nasser and Robert, to just share a few activities For instance, when I do just normal activities like going to shopping, of course, I try to park my car the closest to the entrance of the shops. But I realized, because I've been living here by myself for 10 years, that I make sure that I don't walk out with more than 3 bags, because it would be too heavy to carry. And I also realized that there are things that I can't buy, like, for instance, watermelon. I discovered this because I like watermelon, mm-hmm. and I only get to have it at people's or my friends' places because I can't buy it. And so small things like that, you know, disability affects every aspect of people with disabilities' life, from the moment they wake up to the moment they sleep at night. They do mm-hmm. things differently. They do it difficulty. They manage to do it. But instead of, Nasser said, I happen to have support from my family and attitude that, yes, you can do it. But they do it with difficulty and they do it with longer time. And
simple thing like the coffee this morning.
The coffee this morning.
The coffee, because I know it's a very important thing to Yusuf and yeah. you know, most people.
Yeah, we spoke about that before.
And the
show.
Fact that it's not that easy for you to get out of the car with the coffee and everything else. And these are the things I would
especially
really don't
when
think
the
of.
When the local cafe is on what do you call it?
A hill. A hill. Incline,
and you can't get the door. So there are small things that affect people's life. And I remember I gave a talk last year about the opening of a conference for the makers of my leg brace. They asked me as a guest of honor to open their own technical conference, and they normally ask people who use their products. Like Paralympic team and myself last year, I said to them that people with disability know how to get the best out of their remaining aspects of abilities of their body. And I remember the definition of economy when I did MBA here, because one of the definitions of economy is managing scarce resources. And that's why people with disability, I call them body economists.
Nice. Beautiful.
My own term. Because they really make sure they develop techniques and skills to use or to economize the scarce body resources.
Well, it's lovely to talk to you, my dear friend and body economist.
I'm going to bring watermelon and coffee next week.
Now you know what to bring. I think
yeah, all one.
I think we still have 1 minute. In one of the cultural differences, having lived in the Arab world and lived in Australia, is that people's attitude towards disability here is simple, and people ask you in the street, "What did you do to your leg?" They don't view it as they're interfering in your personal life. Whereas in the Middle East, you don't ask about people's disability. And I knew that because when I in my first month here, on trams and on roads, people had asked me, "What did I do to my?" I didn't do anything to my leg. It was somebody else.
Someone else did it.
Someone else. But sometimes if you travel and and I say this to my fellow Arabs who live in Australia, not to be sensitive towards this question, because people in Australia don't mean anything offensive when they ask you this question. And I remember one day I had, before I discovered my limit, 3 bags shopping, I had probably 4 or 5 bags, and I was struggling walking. So a nosy guy saw me, and he asked me, "Do you need a hand?" And they said, "I actually need a leg. There's nothing wrong with my hands." He liked it, so he said, I'll give you a lift.
Fantastic.
I think with this...
well, we're done. Hey, so thanks very much, Yusuf, on International Day of People with Disability. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Nasser and Robert, for your questions. It helped me to open this discussion. And I also want to say thank you to Khaled. We should see you here more often.
Okay. Just a nod of the head there, everybody.
Just a, like, you can't actually hear a nod, buddy.
And with this, we've come to the end of this week's episode of Palestine Remembered. Thanks for being with us. Do tune in next Saturday, 9:30 in the morning. Until then, have a great time and salam.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia, on the Kulin Nation. For more information and to find out how you can support 3CR, go to www.3cr.org.au.